house with him. So, and that was my longest relationship. I knew her better than any woman I'd ever known before we got together. You know, so I can only look forward now to, you know, who knows. Any questions on that one? Because that's a big area, yeah.
Bob, what do you think causes you to stay in the relationship?
What causes me to stay in the relationship? Oh, because I am the product of a woman who beat me as a child. And therefore, and he wants the questions on tape. You want to ask that again?
Yeah, Bob, what would keep you in a relationship that you don't want to be in?
Being raised by a woman who beat me as a little boy, as I talked about last night, I am terrified of an overtly angry woman. So I am not capable. I am more afraid of making the woman mad. Now I'm talking in past tense. I'm more afraid of making the woman mad than I am of putting myself in a sexual emotional prison. So, and then people say, well, you don't need to go back and work on that childhood stuff. You know, I can't have an honest relationship because of that. I got to go to work on that. I need to get in therapy on that. I need to get out the old wiffle bats and the, you know, batakas and scream and yell and beat and cry and scream and yell and beat and cry until I can get to the point where I can stand up and look the woman I'm with today in the eye and say, you know, when you do that, makes me really angry. Wow, what a change. Communication. And I can listen to her say the same thing to me and not have to get defensive. Well, not for more than a couple of minutes anyway, you know, five. Sometimes I got to say, I'll be back in 10. Give me a minute here with this, because I do have a tendency to overreact. I was like, because I'm immediate. My reaction is not that I did something wrong, but there's something wrong with me. And, you know, you give me that there's something wrong with me instead of I did something wrong, and then I'm like, you know, I'm got to defend that little kid inside. So I have to move to the other room, spend 5 minutes or so, and then I can come back in quietly and sit down with my partner and discuss it and talk about it and listen to her tell me things about my way of whatever that I don't want to hear. I want to be perfect. You know, it's okay I point out two or three faults of yours. They're not a big deal, but let's go easy on me. I'm sensitive, you know. And it, yes, please.
Seeing as how we all have so much problem with the relationships, and I can't ever pick the right guy because I'm always picking my parent, is there any more insight that you can give us on relationships, how not to get messed up? I mean, can you expound on that a little bit? Because I think that's one of our big issues.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure I can expound on it. I have a, you know, I'm going to go into the picking wrong woman Hall of Fame when they open it up. And that's because of my childhood. I'm drawn to women with a lot of covert anger towards men. Can single them out in a heartbeat in a large room full of a lot of people, and I, you know, drawn straight to them. I continue to work on it, get information, deal with my therapist, you know, just get it. And learn that there are things I can do. This one's hard for me. Don't react on my initial reaction. Wait a few minutes. Then if I cannot contain myself, because it's like a magnet sucking me across the room, you know, the red devil picking up the bowling ball, you know, she's just over there, and I'm coming, you know, I can't stop myself. I learned to look in their eyes, because what I want today in a woman's eyes is in a woman's eyes. I never realized that. They had to be perfect physically, because I was so imperfect, I thought. One of the ways I could validate myself was by always having beautiful women on my arm. So I walk in a room, you know, I'm okay. Not because I'm okay, but I'm with her. That's why I'm okay. And I live in Hollywood now, which supports that. So I try to hesitate as long as I can off that initial when I'm drawn to them. And then when I do get close, because I can't keep myself back for a little while, I look into their eyes and I look at their mouths. I find women for me who are covertly angry. This is my dangerous woman. It's in the eyes and it's in the mouth. They have angry mouths. And they can be stunning. I mean, drop dead, wreck your car beautiful, you know? And just a keg of dynamite. In fact, often those women are very angry. And they're angry that they have to go to all that work to look all that good, to feel okay for us men so that they can get attention. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. That magnet's strong. That magnet to the wrong choice is strong. Yes, over here. Let Dan bring you the mic.
Unless it's, I feel like Jerry Springer here. Spare you all from my thought of the day.
This is definitely a much better crowd than the Jerry Springer audience. Trust me. You couldn't get a Jerry Springer audience in this room to do this work. It's about them.
Aren't I always going to be attracted to the same kind of person? I just need to find that kind of person in recovery, working on their own stuff. I mean, can I ever change that much to where I'm not going to be attracted to an unavailable man who doesn't like women?
Well, no, great point, great point. Hey, a very good point. I'm glad you made it. I'm sorry I got so, but I'm so locked into it, dealing it from my point. You know, I've been through that war zone so often, I only see it from that side. But I'm a perfect match for somebody, you know, used to be a perfect match for somebody that was angry at men, because I was as angry at you. I wanted to kill my mother. You know, you became a target. If you find a man in recovery who used to be the type that you were attracted to, he will no longer be that type. If he's done his work, he won't be that type anymore. The trick is to learn to just kind of back away from the initial hit. Go ahead. Well, the question is, won't he still have the initial same hit because of the first thought, because he's done all that work? It's not long enough to get a conversation started. And do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, today I go over the hill from where I live in the valley to Brentwood a lot for a lot of reasons. I have to do a lot of business over there. This has got to be the land of high maintenance women who are pissed off, you know. But it is just a sea of gorgeous women. And I will encounter them daily over there. And once I'm out of my car, I have a chance to start a conversation. They're somewhat object-oriented in that area. And I will see one, and the immediate hit is, oh, yes. Finally. Thank you, God. You know? I mean, this is it. And I, as I get closer with all my new awarenesses and say hi, and she says hi, I will say something to her like, you're very attractive, or you're very beautiful, and have a nice day, and walk away, because now I have seen beyond the initial external person into the real person, and I don't have to go forward just because I said hi. How about when we're in the beginning, we're all really needy physically? You know, we say hi to somebody and I'm going to sleep with you. Even if I don't want to sleep with you. I'm talking about me. I'm not talking about women. Me. We're having a conversation. I need to be held. I don't know how to ask to be held. What's that? So we have sex. I can't just say, take me home and hold me. I just want some affection. I need some affection. I don't need sex. I don't need intellectual conversation. I need affection. Put my head in your lap and stroke my brow, and I'll do the same for you. And we'll just, I couldn't. I mean, the thought of presenting something like that to a woman was inconceivable. You got it? Yeah. Won't stop the hit, but you can't get a conversation started. Yes. Back there, Jerry.
How does one know when to work on the relationship and when to let it go?
Get a third person in the middle of it. Get a family counselor in there. I do not believe that two people together can arrive at that choice. You know? I just don't believe you can. I am a major, major, major proponent nowadays of getting someone in the middle of it. and closing it. If it's not going to work, close it. Go sit with a family counselor, a therapist, and close it up. Okay? Yeah. I can't. Yes, come on. I can't reach that by myself with my partner. Too much stuff going on.
You said something about waiting till she got done with her relationship, or, and that's a pattern that I've had. It's like, as long as it's, you know, all my morals were negotiable before I got in recovery, but then it's not okay to date somebody if they're dating somebody else or this or that. But you said to start it up while somebody was actively involved with somebody else. What, isn't that a setup for a failure in the end? It has been for me.
Well, set up for who? For failure for who?
For me, to just start a relationship knowing that somebody's still involved with somebody else. I don't know, I guess what I'm saying is I have trouble with being, if I meet somebody that's single, that's not good. I'm just judging why they're single. They've got to have something terribly wrong, and but you know, they've been single for 2 years. And so I'm almost looking for that involved with somebody else because, well, they can have one, and so that's proven to me that, you know, they're available eventually if I wait. If that makes sense. I don't know.
Oh no, you're making perfect sense to me. Even I can drink tea in the afternoon, have a cigar, and, you know, carry on a very informative conversation. That's a different thing with different people. We're not all alike, and we're not going to all act alike, you know? I mean, there is a certain validity for many of us to, I use this only because it's the biggest current worldwide example we have, to Clinton saying getting head isn't sex. There are a lot of men and women who feel that way. They just don't consider it as really the, you know, act itself, okay? So, along those lines, for me in relationships, when out in the streets and the first few early years of recovery, being ADD, I need to be intense to focus, okay? I constantly picked women who were either just in and getting out of, or just out of a relationship with a completely insane person. I mean, one of these guys that stands in the bushes, who tries to, you know, knife your tires, who, you know, I mean, I've literally been in the position where we were having sex in bed, and I'm holding the window down on the guy's hands. He's out here, and he wants to get in, and the woman and I are having sex, and I've slammed the window on his fingers. This, for me, is wonderful. This is the kind of intensity that lets me know I'm alive, you know. And I'm telling her I love her, and I'm screaming at him through the window, as soon as I'm done, I'm coming out to get you. And he can't get away because I've got his hands in the window. You know, this is perfect energy for me and my concept of making love. So I lived in that for years. So for me to meet a quiet person, you know, an artistic, sensitive person who's in a situation who basically knows it's ending at some point, but not sure, because they had talked about getting married, is an entirely different place for me. I'm not going to interfere. I'm not going to sleep with her. I'm not going to go, you know, figure out what time he gets home from editing film and make sure I'm there when he comes home so we can have some real fun, you know. I'm just not going to do any of that. And it was interesting how this stuff works. About 3 weeks or 4 weeks after we met, he didn't come home one night. And then she found out he'd been cheating for quite a while. It was over. The relationship was over. Our meeting was definitely a spiritual thing. Because then from that point, see, all Tina and I have to do today is look at our daughter and say, how did we spend the 8 years of our life? What is the end product of this relationship? And we look at this 10-year-old beautiful girl and say, wouldn't change a thing. Would not change a thing. So, you're coming from a different place at this dating process than I am. To me, to do what you might not do would be growth. I mean, for me to do, not to, for, it's too early. You know what I mean, you know. For you to do what I do would not be growth. For me to do what you do is inconceivable. You know, I'm coming from such an extreme in that area. So that's why now, I don't want to be in a relationship with anybody. I don't want to make love up front. I don't want to, you know, I want to try it another way. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to live my way this way the rest of my life. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I may find out this way sucks, and I hate it. And I've dated 9 women, given up a year and a half of my life, and I haven't had any sex at all. You know what I'm saying? In which case then, Jim and I, one of my buddies, and Bobby, the three of us are moving to goddamn Jamaica, and we're going to get a nice house down there and live on the beach and smoke cigars and, you know, get a couple of beautiful young Jamaican women, have a couple of kids, and die on the beach. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not saying I know for sure that this is going to work, but I got to try it. I have to try it. And if I can get into that place with the changes I need to make in my life, because there's no pain in change, none, absolutely no pain in change. All of the pain is in the resistance to the change. It is not in the change itself. It is in the resistance to the change. So if I can get myself in that place where I can give myself permission to try this way, rather than I mandate, I must now live this way the rest of my life, which is a way I have never lived before, I'm screwed. I'm screwed. I will sabotage myself in a heartbeat. But if I can just say, I'm going to try this, and that's where I'm at with this situation. I'm going to try this. I want to try this. It feels right to me. I do not know. And one of my dearest friends is a year longer, sober a year longer than I am, and we're the same age. And we're both going through this right now. And we're both saying the same thing. And then Bobby, who's a little younger, you know, it's like, we're going to try this and try this sincerely and see if we cannot change the way that we operate as men, because we have all of those sensitivities that women like. We're intelligent, we're witty, we have great senses of humor, we're kind, we have good hearts, we're gentle. We have all these elements. We have not necessarily been able to manifest themselves because we've been driving right into the relationship at the gate. So we say, we're going to try this. And we have also said what I said. And this doesn't work, it's Jamaica. You know, where they have affordable Cuban cigars, women that are beautiful. Not pretty, but beautiful. Beautiful women. And, you know, some children and hang out and just live to be 95 on the beach. You know, screw it. Start a meeting for travelers who come through there on cruise ships. One for cigar smokers and one for non-cigar smokers. we just covered this. I locked myself into a course of action without giving serious consideration to alternate behaviors or possible consequences. I saw what we've been talking about. You know, there she is. See, for me, when I get consumed with finding her, and I know who she is. She's tall, slender, blonde, resting against the front fender of her Rolls, right? Has as much money as God, can take care of me. All I got to do is drive the streets and find her. When I am mentally in that place, what I am saying is, where are you, God? I really am, that's what I'm saying. That's my mental image of God. That's the one that is acceptable to me. Are you looking for him? The same him as I am her? You know, it was going to make everything all right. I'm looking for God. And I, you know, I get into that image and I, you know, I nurture that image. And I'm saying, man, where is she? 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 And what I'm saying is, God, where are you? Where are you? Where are you? I do not feel you in my life today. Where are you? It took me years to grasp that. That's my image of God. A beautiful woman, financially secure, who will let me just sit and write novels and I can quit writing this fucking television, which I hate, and you know, where I'm going to be okay forever. That's God's business. That's not my partner's business. I mean, I may find a partner like that sometime and we may be madly in love and live together the rest of our lives and have great joy. But what I'm thinking about her doing for me is God's business, not her business. It's God's business to take care of me. It's God's business to get me in a place where I can sit and write the books I want to write. Stop writing television. So you might think about that next time you're dreaming about your, you know, fantasy love. Are you looking really for your fantasy love? Or do you wonder why God has currently deserted you? That's a huge one for me. A huge one. Well, this I just kind of talked about. I seek tension in crisis and then complain about the results. You're going to have to put your own on that. I just gave you mine, you know. I mean, if the slamming of the window and stuff, seeking tension in crisis and then complaining doesn't get it, you know. I avoid conflict or aggravate it. Rarely do I deal with it. Well, that's because most of us did not grow up in homes that are solution-oriented. This is the problem. How do we fix it? My home was just looking for somebody to blame. It couldn't be fixed. They threw it away. Then became more affluence in the society. So the method became, it doesn't work, throw it out, buy a new one. And then the children who have grown up in those homes, whereas if it doesn't work, throw it out, buy a new one, they do that with people, the children of those parents. They throw people out and find a new one. It's just like throwing the toaster out or the... They asked Paul Newman one time in an interview, why come their marriage had lasted so long, he and Joanne Woodward, in a business where it's notorious that no marriage is left. He says, when the toaster breaks at our house, we fix it. I thought that says it all. The toaster breaks, they fix it. Certainly they're capable of throwing it out and buying a new one. But that is that becomes a pattern that gets moved into other areas of your life. And think about how many people do that with people. Next time something breaks in your home, if you have the money to throw it away and buy a new one, why don't you fix it? It might be much more satisfying than throwing it away. And it may change how you relate to people over a very short period of time and their problems. Instead of throwing them away, you may be able to hang in there and be supportive while they fix it. Yeah.
I grew up, had two alcoholic parents, and they were real angry. And I've worked through a lot of anger, but I still have some. I mean, what do you do? What's the solution? We talk about solutions, just to let go of that. I wish I could just, here, throw it away.
Yeah, rip it out of your being and throw it away. Okay.
Yeah. Can we talk about that?
Okay. There were times when maybe Alexandra was three, my daughter. And this is a child, as I said last night, I used to sit in the rocking chair by her crib and weep. Just weep. I was so overjoyed with her presence in my life. I mean, I was just so, oh God, it was so wonderful. Such a miracle. And there were times, particularly in the threes, when I would want to double up my fist and hit her in the corner of the eye. Right here. Why on God's earth, when I love someone as much as I love this child, the only person I have ever met I would give my life for, We were in therapy once in the beginning, and Tina said, well, if we were in a situation where it was me or Alexandra, what would you do? And I said, you don't want me to answer that. You do not want me to answer that. Let's just assume I would always put forth my best effort to save both of you. But I knew in my heart I would save my daughter. I would save my daughter. It wasn't even an issue with me. So I adore her. I love her. I would give my life for her, and I want to punch her in the side of the head. That's because I'm from anger, okay? I count to 10. That's it. Count to 10, I no longer have to punch her. Why would I want to punch her? Because I know it works. It was done to me. She will either stop doing what it is that I want her to stop doing, or she will start doing what it is I want her to do, and that process will be as simple as hitting her right here. So that's what my mother used to do, is tear out these corners, hit me in the corner of the eye. But the pain is beyond belief, beyond belief. And that's why I want to do that to my daughter. I know it works. Fuck time out. She won't go. You know? I've given her 6 choices and she said she doesn't like any of them. You know? What do you do now? You know? And I'm an internal. I'm like, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll hit her. And I just go away. I set some strong boundaries. Go away. Get a wiffle bat, plastic bat, take it somewhere in the house, the yard, where she's not around, where she can't get my energy, because Tina will be with her by now, because we worked as a team when the other of us would get angry, and beat the shit out of a tree or a wall or a, you know, 2x4 in the garage or something with it until I physically exhaust the anger. The anger must physically come out. You can do all the intellectual work you want on anger, and if you don't deal with it physically, it will still be there, and it'll be there in unacceptable proportions. If you get to the work, and the work, my experience with the work is it's really hard. Really, really hard. It's like, I did tons of work like that, and then I didn't do any for a number of years. I'm okay. I'm fixed. Tina and I lived in Tucson. We had her dying mother with us. After her mother was a member of the Hemlock Society. This is not something I'm going to go into great details on, but I'll just cover it. Her mother woke up one morning and said to us, and that's, just forget the process of having someone sick and dying in your house, in this room, and in this room, a 3-year-old. You know what I'm saying? And It was, and mother and daughter, which was, you couldn't tell who the patient was some days. I mean, I'm serious. We were talking about this stuff last night. It was just madness. Now, Tina, to her credit, is one of the best networkers I have ever known in my life. She's never had a job. She's been an artist all of her life. But when she needs stuff, she knows how to find it. The first thing she found in Tucson, because we were in Kingman. Any of you ever been to Kingman? Whoa. I won't comment any further on that. Looks pretty, but I was telling, I can't even remember. We had breakfast this morning. Tina and I were sitting up there in Kingman. We'd been there for 20 months with her mother. And we had a beautiful home, lots of acres. I mean, you just say, oh, it's heaven. Look at the wallapies and the mesas and lots of places to hike. And we were so miserable. We wanted to die. Strange people. I'll just leave it at that. That's where the Arizona Patriots were practicing their bombing. You know, I mean, never mind. Anyhow, one morning we opened the state, your state newspaper here. One of your highly conservative state legislators said that Tucson was the Venice Beach of Arizona. Tina and I were on a plane the next morning to Tucson looking for houses, saying, well, at least we'll fit, you know, if nothing else. We'll be okay in Tucson, you know. So we moved to Tucson, and we moved the dying mom to Tucson, and we moved the 3-year-old daughter to Tucson, and mom's there, and she's there for less than a year, and she wakes up one morning and says to Tina and I, okay, I'm done, this is it. This is it. This is my last day. I do not want to do another day. If any of you know anything about the Hemlock Society, assistance must be provided when the person makes a choice like this. I'm not, needless to say, I mean, if you were in a situation and you wanted this to be your last day, who would you pick? I'm a good choice. You know, if I care about you, I'm a good choice, because I will somehow get involved. My best friend and I have a pact, which neither one of us would ever break, and we know it. If somehow, through an accident, I ever get hooked up, he'll unplug me and I'll unplug him. And I do not need to worry that that's going to happen. I know he will. I know he will if he has to be hauled out by the security guards in a hospital, and he knows the same thing with me. So I'm at peace with that. I know, even though I've signed all the no extraordinary care, I don't have to ever worry Tommy will unplug me. I'm cool. I'm all right. So that's her last day. And it went peacefully for the most part. There was some bad times, but our daughter got to spend a lot of time with her head on her grandma's tummy, and she knew her grandma was dying. I mean, we kept her involved in all that, you know, what was going on. And we'd already had the death of a number of animals that we loved, so she was already getting too hip for death for her age. Then after grandma dies and is cremated, I begin to notice, as I'm driving around Tucson day after day after day, I'm getting angrier and angrier and angrier and angrier, till I'm thinking about carrying a gun in the car to shoot one of these people in traffic. And one of the guys who worked at the university down there has written a number of books, is like one of these experts on anger. He's retired, but he is a very dear friend of a friend of mine. And so my friend said, you got to see this guy and talk to him. So I called him, went up to where he doesn't work, but he still has all his stuff in his house. We talked for a couple hours. And he said, well, you know, come back tomorrow. Let's get to the physical part of this tomorrow. And I didn't know where we were going, because I still couldn't put my finger on where the anger was coming from and what it was about and this and that and this and that. The next day I come back, and he said, you know, I want you to know that what you did was very courageous. It took lots of love and lots of courage to do what you did. I completely lose it. I begin to sob and cry. I get the bataka bat. I'm beating the shit out of this huge triangle, screaming and yelling. I'm tired of people telling me that what I did was wonderful, because I wanted her dead. I wanted her dead. Really, underneath all of it. She was a major pain in the ass. She was a complete bitch. She tried to encroach her entire family with money. Tina and her fought all the time. She was practically incapable of any physical affection to either of her children, my wife or her son, or Alexander. Alexander got the most of all, and that would be sitting in her lap for 15 minutes watching television. She never turned her television set off. I mean, it was like this was like having Godzilla live in your fucking house. He's 4'10" and 90 pounds, you know, and is controlling the entire family, the house, the nanny, I mean everything. So what I hadn't told anybody is I wanted the woman dead. But once I got the physical anger out at her, you know, as sick as this sounds, she's dead, she's died, she's suffered, she died from ends of emphysema and cancer. Emphysema is the worst death on this planet I've ever seen. And, you know, here's a woman who used to be a championship duck hunter, and her life has been reduced to 1.5 steps from the bed to the portable potty. That's it. You know, it's a murderous thing. But I wanted her gone, and I had to deal with my anger over who she was at the time she was with us, because I never dealt with it then. So I must physically get the anger out, or I'm not free from it. I'm not free from it. And times I don't want to do it, and it's embarrassing, and you know, and I'm alone. I'm alone, and I have the wiffle bat, and I'm embarrassed. Who cares? There's no one there. And I can't, you know, I'll do little, you know, I should be punching holes in the plaster. I don't do that, only because I'm a championship stud finder. You know? If you got one of those electronic stud finders, you can't find the stud in your house, call me. I will. I got a knack for finding studs. Yeah. wait for Jerry.
Have you ever thought about who or what it is you're beating when you go and do the wiffle bat?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's the little boy. My little boy. It's my little boy who never got even for what was done to him when he was small. That's why the size of my anger. See, for me, if I don't deal with the childhood stuff, the size of my reactions, particularly my emotional reactions to situations, will always be inappropriate. Because I can get really homicidal over insignificant things. And it's because of something from this little kid that never got dealt with. And he's still mad over what was done to him. I mean, that childhood was 60 years ago, and he's still mad. And I have worn blisters off of both my hands with Bataka bats.
He's doing the beating, or he's...
He is doing the beating, the anger. This is the little guy who was... See, that's... I had a lot of trouble getting a sponsor in the beginning in sobriety. Because I would look them in the eyes when they'd say, tell me about yourself, and I would, and I'd say, the only thing I don't understand here is these people are talking about fear. I've never been afraid in my life, I've never been in a situation I'm afraid of, and I've never met a man I was afraid of. Well, I was completely insane, of course, okay? And I was coming from a child who lived in terror. And I swore to God I'd never live that way again. So I was never going to let anybody frighten me. I met guys, man, 6 feet, 300 pounds, and all I knew is they were going down. I didn't know how. I didn't know if it would be a pipe, a bar, if I was going to have to shoot them, but they're going to go down. I mean, I never thought that they were going to get me. It would never entered my mind, but my little boy always knew they were going to get him. He always knew they were going to get him. So he's still mad. Now, get it, the size of his anger has diminished tremendously because it's being expressed. Now, when he needs a two-hour session with a Bataka bat and can just wear the blisters right off his hands, I, on the other hand, as an adult male who has been working recovery, if I am angry at you over a male thing, you know, an adult male thing, I may not even have to use a Bataka bat or a baseball bat. Or if I do, it's like 5 minutes. You know, just... That son of a bitch cheated me on that contract. Damn son of a bitch. And I'm done and I'm going to have breakfast. You know what I'm saying? The kid, if he's in it too, because he was betrayed like that when he was a child, I'm there an hour, man. Sweat's pouring off of me. Tears are coming. You know, I just blow completely off the chart. It's the kid. When it gets that big, it's the kid. That's a good rule of thumb. When you're any reaction of yours is so out of proportion to the event, look back to your childhood and see what it is. Betrayal is a huge one. John and I were conducting a grief workshop one time. We'll get to you in 1 second. We're conducting a grief workshop one time, and we were having two women were in the front row, both of whom were trashed. Just trashed. Okay? Tears, sobbing, they moved out of their chairs, they got on the floor. And what we wanted the group we were doing the grief work to know is that we knew nothing about these women, but we'd find the most emotionally distressed ones, because we wanted people to see that the level of emotion was the same, but what they were grieving over was not the same, right? So we get to this first one, and she was grieving in an abortion she had had. She finally let all of the feelings of it come to her. And she was so sad and so angry and just sobbing. The other woman was grieving the loss of her high chair. You might say, huh? Abortion? High chair? She came home from school one day and her parents had given her high chair away. Okay? That's betrayal. May seem insignificant to you, but it's not to a child. And that stuff will haunt us as adults our whole life if we don't do something about it. And for most of us who are in this room, betrayal is a big part of our childhood. And it's hard to find because it's subtle. It's little things. It's not always big things. It's very subtle. In the back, she has something.
I wanted to know, what's the appropriate way for children to express their anger, like a four-year-old, for example?
There's a few ways. One is, of course, they can just take one of their stuffed animals and beat the crap out of it. That's perfectly okay. One is they can have a wiffle bat. They can take a wiffle bat, take a few swings at a tree, a fence post or something. Or one they seem to like the process of, but not the consequences of, is tearing up brown paper bags from the market. Just ripping them to shreds all over their room. What they don't like is the consequences, which is they get to pick up the pieces. And it's essential that they pick up the pieces. So those are all good ways. They can do the same ways we do. You know, my therapist said to me one time a line she blew me away with. She said, one of the cruelest sayings we currently have in our society today is puppy love. She said, there's absolutely no such thing as puppy love. A child's love is as huge to them as our adult love is to us, and should be treated with the same respect and not dismissed with a phrase like puppy love. If you want to read a very powerful book on all this stuff, it is, well, when I think of it, I'll give it to you. God, Alice Miller's...
This is the end of tape number one. Please go on to tape number two.